Osiris.
Hi, this is Mimi with Fruition, and the podcast you are listening to is part of the Osiris Network. Osiris is creating a community that connects people like you with podcasts and live experiences about artists and topics you love. They'll be doing many live events this summer around the country, which will include artist interviews, contests, and more. Sign up for the newsletter at osirispod.com to stay in the loop.
We're here with Dolph Ramsor, who you may know is the sponsor of our podcast, the original sponsor of our podcast, the godfather of North Carolina music.
Dolph being a sponsor of our show literally helps us keep the lights on, keeps batteries in the Zoom recorder, keeps the microphone cables working. Dolph, we appreciate all your support over the past year.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be a part of it.
We've been running an ad for the Ruin Brothers, which is one of the new albums that came out that you guys put out, but was produced by Rick Rubin, correct?
Correct. Correct.
I texted Dolph after like the second time we ran it and told him that I've never seen a more effective advertisement because it had worked on my entire family. Because after I heard that ad on my own podcast a couple times when I was editing it, my wife listens to the Ruin Brothers all the time now, and I've listened to that album several times. It worked on us, man.
Well, that's great to know. That's great. And they're such talented guys, and they're sweet fellas as well. They're from the north of England, Scunthorpe, which is a very working class area.
As I said the first time we had you on the introduction, maybe over a year ago, and I said that I've known Dolph like over a decade, and he's only ever sponsored really good things and put his name behind really good things, and I didn't know if this was going to be the one that broke him, and I didn't want to be a part of it, but a year later, we're still going, and we're thankful for it.
Well, again, glad to be a part of it, and y'all keep rocking. I'll keep rocking and having some fun doing it.
Big team, little me.
Yes.
That's right. So check out the Ruin Brothers album and all the other albums and the bands on Ramsor Records. You can go to ramsorrecords.com, and you can, if you're interested in any of the albums there, you can enter the promo code HISTORY and get 10% off. So go do it. Show Dolph some love, and we're thankful for him.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Thank you. I'm Bob Crawford.
I'm Ben Sawyer.
This is the holiday end of year, see you later 2018 edition of The Road to Now.
Yes, it is. This is it, 2018. Another great year for The Road to Now, Bob.
I would say the best year yet.
Yes.
I mean, just definitely. Based on the guests that we had and the fact that we're still doing it, those two things make it the best year yet.
I know. And we're like, here we are at the end of another year. But we also know from looking at our numbers that a lot of you guys are like, what are you talking about? This is our first year here, because we've gotten so many new listeners this year. And it's awesome.
We have. And it wasn't an easy year. We lost Ian.
We lost Ian.
God rest his soul.
God rest his soul. Last time I saw him, he was still held under that brush in the Cumberland. He had yet to let go. But I believe that somebody eventually will come along and save him. He's worth it.
We miss him.
We do. I went to a Spurs match yesterday with Solomon and thought maybe I'd see him there with the Nashville Spurs, but alas, no Ian, which makes perfect sense if you've got a kid that's less than a year old.
That makes very, very good sense. But we gained some new friends, new Road to Now employees.
That's right. We got the person who is editing this, the first person who will hear this recorded, and the person who always makes it sound great, our friend Gary Fletcher. Of Which Is Better podcast, another Osiris podcast, a hilarious one. I am thankful this year for Gary Fletcher, who keeps us sane and puts up with us doing things like, I don't know, recording the intro to a podcast that's going to launch in 8 hours when we recorded the interview part last week, and he can be done with it, and he still puts up with us.
Gary does not have a newborn child.
No, he doesn't. Gary, do not have a child. Do you hear us? Do not have a child.
Or,
just kidding. Have a child.
Or adopt a 19-year-old that can be your assistant.
That's true. I have to say this. Gary Fletcher would be a great dad. He really would.
He seems like a great guy. Seems like a wonderful guy. And then speaking of mere children, we have a young fella working for us.
The dynamic, the musically talented Austin Sawyer, no relation. Austin Sawyer, we love you. He keeps the social media going.
He's doing a good job.
He is doing a good job. I just had lunch with him the other day, and he's everywhere. I got to say, he's everywhere.
Is he keeping his grades up?
I would imagine.
He's got a lot going on. He's got music. He's got
the podcast, and he's a full-time student, right?
Right, and he interned with the Americana Music Association and played their festival this year. If you haven't heard Drumming Bird, I'm telling you, like, their music is so catchy. Like, I agreed to listen to it, and immediately it became in rotation, like, in my house. And my wife, who has way better taste in music than me, was like, "That's Austin?" I was like, "Yeah, he's great." So,
well, we're glad we're to have to have him, it. And we hope that his music won't get in the way and inhibit his social media duties here at the Road to Now. It's hard to find people that are just all in.
Bob, one of the things that I'm thankful for this podcast for is the fact that we get to talk to people whose books I've read for years and whose people that I'm blown away by and people I never knew before the Road to Now, because it gives you a chance to show up and ask them questions. I always tell people, if you show up and corner somebody you want to talk to that doesn't know you and you just start asking them questions, you're a stalker.
Yes.
You end up getting a restraining order. But if you do the same thing with a microphone, you're a host and you get acclaim. And today we're having on the podcast, for the third time, one of my all-time favorite historians, the great thinkers of our era in terms of history, Jefferson Cowie.
Yes, if we had an economic expert that we go to all the time, I think it would be Jeff Cowie.
Yeah, but not just economics. He's quantitative and qualitative. He sees the big picture. And in this one, we went back to one of his earlier works because of questions we had. And this episode is on the 1970s, a decade that right after it ended, people said, well, nothing happened back then. And then, but as disco, it turns out, maybe everything happened.
That's right.
And for today's episode, we're taking it back a little bit. And we're going to talk to Jeff about the 1970s and the book he wrote, Staying Alive, The 1970s and the Last Days of the Working Class, which came out in print in 2010. But tomorrow, if you're listening to this live, and for the rest of you on December 18th, 2018, premieres as an audiobook on Libro.fm. Libro.fm is our sponsor. You can go to Libro's website, put in the promo code RTN, and you can support us. You can support Jeff. You can support your local bookstore. And if you put in that promo code, you get 3 months of membership for $15. That's 3 books, one of which you can get Staying Alive by Jefferson Cowie. So if you like this episode, go check it out.
Become a Libro.fm subscriber. Become a member of the community. It's the best way to listen to an audiobook.
It is. It is. It really I love is. It.
And you're supporting your local bookstore while you're doing it.
I know. Bob, can I say that I feel creepy now because I love this. I love it so much. And now that they're our sponsor, I feel like everyone looks at me when I tell them about Libro FM. They're like, is this a cult or something? This guy seems way too happy about it.
But it's a good model. See, I mean, because if you're like Ben and I, where we love bookstores, I mean, I love on my day off, I could spend hours in a bookstore and often do. But I love audiobooks. I mean, because like, in fact, the book, we have a guest coming on in January, Edward Baptist is his name. He wrote a book called The Half Has Never Been Told, and I purchased the book last week, and I'm reading it, but a couple days went by, I didn't have much time to read, and I said, I gotta get this from Libro so I can listen to it, so I'm always taking the book in, and so when I do the interview, I'll be ready, you know. And can I just tell you how much more enjoyable it is to listen to a book these days than listen to the news? If you listen to the news like I do, it's a lot more fun, and I'm listening to the news less, and I think I'm happier.
Bob, I've noticed you've been happier.
Have you? Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yeah. So listen to this podcast. Listen to Jeff's book or any book you want to on Libro.fm, and have a beautiful New Year's and happy 2019.
The best wishes of the season from us to you. Thank you so much.
God bless. All right. So we're here with Jeff Cowie, Jefferson Cowie, Dr. Jefferson Cowie, the man, the legend,
I hate doctor. I want to be professor or just Cowie or Jeff or guy with the nose. I don't care.
All right, guy with the nose. We're here with guy with the nose. We brought him here to talk about
that
nasal
jerk
history.
From Nashville. How about that?
No, we're here at Jefferson Cowie's place in Nashville. It's a old factory from 1877. It's a beautiful place. And just as I got here, Jeff said, hold on a second. I need to send off an email. He said, I'm going to submit a manuscript for a book. And he just sent it off. And hey, Jeff, you should tell Bob what the book's about.
Well, it's a chapter in a book honoring Bruce Springsteen's 70th birthday.
Oh, my gosh. That's awesome.
Yeah. So, like, Grail Marcus is in it and, you know, all these rock critics and stuff like that. And me.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the other guy.
Jeff, I have a very personal Springsteen story.
If it's going to make me jealous, I don't know if I want to hear it.
When my daughter was sick in the hospital, like, the earliest days, our manager was thinking, what can we do for Bob? Because my wife and I were obviously in a world of hurt. And mm-hmm. I mean, that's something where there's nothing that can help that or soothe that. And so we were in her room, in the intensive care room one night. I look at my phone, I missed a call. It was from a private number, which I never answer private numbers, just so people out there know. I never answer private numbers. And I checked, I had a message, and it was, hey, Bob, this is Bruce. Dolph told me your daughter's got sick. I just, I'm so sorry. If there's anything I can do, let me know. I'll try again later. So the next night, I pick up my phone. I have another missed call from a private number, and I check the message. It says, hey, Bob, this is Bruce. You know, I'm not trying to give you, I don't want to be imposed in any way, but I'm really concerned about your daughter, and Dolph gave me your number. Hey, here's my number. If you get a minute, give me a call, whatever. Again, I'm very sorry. I know you're going through a tough time, whatever. Wow. So I called him, and we talked for about 35 minutes, and I just walked out in the hallway, and I mean, the reason why I played guitar and took guitar lessons when I was 14 years old was because of him.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm from South Jersey, you know? Growing up was the first thing I ever learned.
Oh.
And I just wanted to – I didn't even want to be in a band at that point. I just wanted to learn how to play his songs. And so if it was any other point in my life, I would have been completely nervous, not knowing what to say. I had fantasized many times in my life, if I ever met him, what would I say?
Right.
And this was like the moment where it was no longer the icon.
Wow.
The untouchable saint. He was just someone who was asking me how my daughter was doing. I got on the phone. He's like, hey, how's it going? I'm like, he asked what was going on. And I was like, it's going okay, Bruce. Here's what happened. And we were just talking like dad to dad. And he talked about when one of his children they had some trouble birthing one of his children, and how he just prayed that he would trade anything for that child to be okay. And we just talked about health and kids and family. And I remember we were getting off the phone, and it was the earliest moments of the 2012 election cycle. And so there was like a Republican debate on that night. Mm-hmm. He's like, well, I got to go watch politics. I'm going to go watch the Republican debate. And I said, hey, Bruce, one question. What are you reading? So I know what he was reading. And he was reading the Joe Torre biography that I guess had just come out. This is 2011. And the Unbreakable, about the world, about the guys that got lost at sea. They crashed. It was a major film was made about it, based on a true story. And then he asked me what I was reading.
I saw the film, preview, right.
And I talked to him about Tolstoy for a minute, and I think I lost him at that point. And then he said, you know, as an aside, I'm a big fan of the music.
Oh.
So that was it. That was my – and we texted for about 6 months.
Wow.
And then, you know, he stopped returning my texts. I would send him pictures of Hallie you know, it was great. So anyway, that's my Springsteen
story.
What
a wonderful story. I mean, the guy's got a big heart. There's no doubt about it, right?
I'm not the only person. Like, that's what he does. Like, I was just another person he does that for. I've heard other people tell similar stories.
Well, Bob, now your Bruce Springsteen story is my Bruce Springsteen story, because that's the best Bruce Springsteen story I've ever heard.
And that may be the only Bruce Springsteen story you've ever heard, Ben.
Well, hey, don't limit me. Speaking of limited, let's talk about stagflation, all right?
Yeah, because we're limited on time.
That's right, we are, because Bob's got a secret mission he's on right now.
Right.
Yes,
I am.
I am in an undisclosed location.
Bob was in a bunker. Behind him, there are men with masks on holding machetes. We're going to get him out, though. They said if this episode is good enough, they'll free him. So,
okay.
You grew up in the 1970s. I was born in the 1970s. Jeff Cowie, what's up with the 1970s? What? I mean, it's funny because you sent me a review to read of your book, In the Nation. And it blows my mind because, like, now I've really been thinking about the 70s in my class, you know, because that's not my area. And I go back over it, but I always pick a couple of new things to become more well-read on. And this time it's the 70s. And this whole idea that for the first generation, people thought, man, not much happened in the 70s. Except for we lost crisis in America. Yeah. Like, we lost all faith in America, right? Like, we just lost faith in it. Like, could you? What? I mean, it's the decade, people end the decade worse off than they start.
Yeah. No, yeah. But the main book on the 1970s prior to the recent, you know, the last 10 years of scholarship was called It Seemed Like Nothing Happened. Right. And which is true. It does seem like, but then when you dig below the surface, there's these tectonic shifts in American politics, culture, economics that have created the landscape that we're on today. I really think the 70s are sort of did for the last several decades what the 30s and 40s did for the post-war era. It sort of set the terms of politics, the coalitions, the economic logic that would go forth for a couple generations. I now think we are actually at the end of that paradigm here in the Trump era. But, you know, that we don't know about that one yet.
So you're saying that we are right now at the beginning of something new?
I think so. Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think, you have this attack on neoliberalism from the left with Bernie Sanders, on the right, Donald Trump, and this sort of bipartisan neoliberal logic seems to be exhausting itself. What comes out of it, though, is anybody's guess.
One of the things that really fascinated me, and I learned, and now I'm going to pick up this Judy Stein book about the 70s. I mean, just this idea that Jeff shaking his head, no. Gary, get that out.
You asshole.
No, but this idea that, like, the 1970s is this era where, you know, I guess the argument is that we just sell out American trade.
Yeah, basically, she makes the argument that, in this, as the subtitle of the book goes, we move from factories to finance, and makes a fairly robust argument in terms of foreign economic policy, we essentially encourage this through our trade structures rather than protecting industry in a variety of ways that could have been done. And I don't even mean formal protections like tariffs, like we're talking about today, but I think Judith Stein's a great scholar, but I think it's a little too monocausal. So that's why in my book I try to look at it from all of these other angles, popular culture, politics, labor, work, you know, and see the same problem emerging from a whole number of vectors, not just trade policy.
And what is the problem?
The problem, the way I see it, from my politics, is that everything that was built in the 30s and 40s fell apart in the 1970s. So, you know, there's sort of bookends to this post-war era, and you have the whole New Deal paradigm, collective bargaining and all these redistributive functions of the state, and corporate leadership and things like that all worked in a certain way. That becomes undone, and then we have this new world that's sort of in this compressed atmosphere of stagflation that forces a series of policy decisions that are either going to go one way or the other. It's either going to be more government intervention in the economy, in social life, or we're going to have to move and just sort of let the corporations run the show. And it wasn't clear how the decade was going to go, but it ends up being the corporations will run the show. And I think what's often lost in a lot of 70s stories is there's this sense of possibility that it could go any direction. It's a decade up for grabs. My guy's lost.
So let's break it down. Okay, so let's start with the beginning. Where do you begin the 70s? Is the beginning like of course the 70s begin in 1970, but does this begin in 68 with the incoming Nixon administration?
Right. No, that's a great question. And this is the problem with decades as you know frameworks for understanding a given era, because history doesn't map on decades. Right. When did the 60s begin with? Kennedy assassination in 63 with a Port Huron statement in 62, you know, I don't know, right? But there's two possible answers. One is 1968, and that's a political story. Right. Things falling apart at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago 50 years ago, and Nixon sort of rushing in and able to claim the throne from the Democrats. The other would be 73, 74. With the gas crisis, I think.
Okay. Well, I mean, which do you think is more relevant?
I think that it's the kind of supercharged collision of those two things. You know, inflation is creeping up because of Vietnam during the early Nixon administration, the first one, and you know, so those problems are there. And the right is gaining considerable traction. But Nixon is still working very much within a liberal paradigm as a president. He's a Republican working with a liberal Congress in a liberal paradigm, more interested in foreign affairs than he is domestic policy. So there's weaknesses there, but it's for the liberal coalition, but they're not deadly yet. When stagflation comes along, which is a combination of high unemployment and inflation, which defied economic logic of the time, defies Keynesian logic. Now you have a situation which your post-war policy measures don't work, which is to say the liberals' position used to be, okay, let's create a government program to take care of that. Poverty? Government program, you know, whatever it is. Any kind of government initiative after inflation kicks in means probably more inflation. And so it's going to be very difficult for liberals to come up with their traditional kinds of answers to the questions.
And this has a lot to do with unhinging us from the gold standard, right?
Yeah, it has. I think that's I often think that's a little overwrought. I mean, I think a lot of people think that. I think the gold standard question ends up being a kind of a leads into crazy deep state stuff, you know. I think it was a reaction to a host of sort of pretty real problems. But the idea of having a free floating currency in that you can exchange with a variety of nations, and the dollar not being the single standard, it's not a terrible idea. And in terms of the world order, I mean, there's no reason that the United States should be at the head of that table.
No, I'm just saying that, like, but the truth is, once you depeg from gold, you can print more money because money becomes another thing that is subject to supply and demand, and mm-hmm. it's politically easier just to print money. And this is at the heart of it, one of the issues, right? Because you print more money, inflation goes up faster than wages go up, and your average person, even though the nominal amount they earn goes up across the decade, the real value of the dollar it goes down, and that's not possible unless you unpeg, right?
Well, yeah. I think you have the question is wages and prices. Are we really going to talk about economics? Are we really going here? You guys are so much more fun than this question. So it was much easier to discipline the labor market than it was the price market. Uh-huh. So whether it's collective bargaining agreements, minimum wages, whatever, jawboning, that is getting the president basically trying to convince people to keep wages down, corporations are going to show up and go, no problem, we got you back. But it's very difficult to control prices without World War II level price controls. You know, and there was a wage price freeze, of course, but it was temporary.
So politically speaking, a word that I've always associated with the Nixon years is triangulation.
Say more.
Triangulation. Yeah. I've read it, and I believe the book was, and you're friends with this gentleman, the Nixon Land?
Uh-huh. Rick Perlstein.
Rick Perlstein. So Nixon would capitalize on the Democratic Party initiatives and make them his own.
Right.
And Bill Clinton did the same thing.
Right. Yeah.
So we're very familiar with our current political the different groups and ideologies that make up particular parties. Like the Democrats, there's a liberal wing that is gaining traction. Then there's the moderate wing. And then in the Republican Party, there's always been this libertarian conservative mm-hmm. tension. And now it's the Trumpist, if you will, have like really taken over that party. What was the Republican Party? What was the makeup of the Republican Party when Nixon was president? And did he struggle more against his own party in this first term or against the Democratic Party?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, Nixon spent so much time conniving politically against both his own party and the Democrats, which got him into nothing. But that's why we got into Watergate, right? Bugging the Democratic National Headquarters. He's obsessed. And one of the interesting things about Nixon is what he wants to do is create the post-Roosevelt coalition. And once you know that, all the pieces fall into place. And the core of his agenda was to carve out white working class voters who were in the Democratic Party to follow their material interests. And he's going to win them over on culture, patriotism, the war, foreign policy, masculinity, all that kinds of stuff, right? And so he has these enormous political efforts. He has this blue collar report written about how, you know, what are their interests and how can they win them? And he orchestrates silly events like, you know, he makes an alliance with the Teamsters and things like this. So what he wants to do is really build that post New Deal coalition. And he sees kind of that white working class as the key. And if it hadn't been for Watergate, I think that whole Reagan coalition would have emerged at that point. Right. But of course, He blew that one.
To be fair, he did get everyone to come together on something. It was just impeaching him.
Yeah, that's true. Although not everybody. And it took a really long time. We forget that, right? It's 2 years between the break-in and the impeachment, you know? Yeah. So it's always worth thinking about that in these times, that these things take a long time to unroll. So he actually considered renaming the Republican Party to the Conservative Party or something like this. But what he wanted to build was what he called the New American Majority that would basically and he wasn't sure the Republicans actually would be flexible enough to do this, that they would be sort of keep up that old kind of country club version of themselves and not want to tarnish themselves with this sort of gritty, you know, the horny hand of labor kind of thing.
But now look at it.
Right.
Right? That Republican Party, It's almost the realization of that.
It's completely the realization of that. It's completely Nixon was prescient in this calculation. There's no and he's going against McGovern too, right?
But now it's only that, right? I mean, you would think that Trump is maybe losing business in a way,
right? Well,
perhaps.
Well, all political coalitions are problematic, right? There's these weird bedfellows. For instance, the Democratic coalition had the civil rights and the segregationist Democrats in the same political bed. Doesn't make any sense, but that's how it worked for decades in the post-war period. The tension in the Republican coalition as it emerges from Nixon and then Reagan is the cultural conservatives, you know, who want to use the state to control people's behavior, whether it's prayer in schools or, you know, abortion or, you know, whatever it's going to be. And libertarians that you were just talking about, the free marketeers who want to strip back the state and free capital. So, and those are odd bedfellows that have been in rubbing up against each other really throughout the Reagan and onward all the way up till now. Now you're seeing the cultural values eclipsing the libertarians. tariffs and the promise of infrastructure and, you know, all this kind of stuff that Trump has talked about.
And this is what gets me. And this is, you know, I mean, I think I mostly know the answer to this question, but I think it's like it's this question, right? Which is, if you look at like the rise of the moral majority, look at the rise of evangelical Christianity as a force on the national political stage, it happens at a time where you have America's really only born again Christian in the office. A guy whose values are conservative, a guy who still to this day gives Sunday school lessons at his class, the guy you would think, if they picked any president, they would pick Jimmy Carter. Wow. And yet they don't. They go with Reagan, the guy who, I don't know, his wife was into astrology, all the stuff that I heard going to small churches.
A divorcee?
Yeah, a divorcee.
A Hollywood, that is one of the most interesting things is how the moral majority shifts to the right. And now you have to figure out, you kind of have to detangle questions of evangelical Christianity in America from whiteness. And that's another very, very complicated thing. Because, I mean, it's the same with Obama. Probably the most upright in terms of, I don't know what he believes in his heart of hearts in terms of his relationship with God, but an upstanding family man, Christian, more than Christian acting, I would say, more than any other president, more than Clinton, more than Bush, more, you know, and he's vilified.
La Cosecha Coffee Roasters provides fresh roasted coffee grown in a sustainable manner where the farmer is given a fair price, which means the coffee goes straight from the harvest to your cup. The best part? You can get 10% off your next purchase by using the promo code RTN1010 at checkout. Visit lacosecha.com. Or follow the links at theroadtonow.com.
Today was George H.W. Bush's state funeral at the Basilica in Washington, D.C. And it was pointed out by more than one journalist that when they said the Apostles' Creed, which is the essential doctrine of Orthodox Christianity, you had in the front row, you had Mr. and Mrs. Carter, President and Mrs. Carter. You had President and Mrs. Secretary of State Clinton. You had Barack Obama, Michelle Obama. And then next to them, you had the current president and his wife. And the only two people that did not lip say the Apostles' Creed,
right,
was from that memory, not reading it, but saying it, were the Trumps. And they could have read it. They didn't even read it. And so someone pointed out, probably snarkily, but you can't read tone on Twitter, that, hey, the Muslim is reading the, you know, ha-ha, who the man who's been accused and vilified, you shouldn't be vilified for being a Muslim, but he, the man who was vilified in that respect knows the Apostles' Creed. And then the man who 81% of white evangelicals in the 2016 election raised up as the I don't want to say Messiah, but as their deliverer, their great deliverer, doesn't know it or refuse to say it.
So, well, you're a man of faith. What do you make of that?
I mean, I think he doesn't know it and doesn't care to say it. I don't think he really cares about anything but himself. But that's not for me. You know, that was my, that if I'm being honest about the what comes to mind, what I would, my knee-jerk reaction is that he's not religious. He's not religious at all.
No, everything's an instrument, I think, for him, including that. But my question is not what Trump knows. It's why have white evangelicals backed a man who stands out in that specific way against this whole pantheon of individuals?
I think some are practicing bad theology. I think others, like Mr. Trump himself, understand it to be a transactional relationship. You give us what we've always wanted, that has been promised to us by Reagan, both Bushes, that we never got. And then we will give you the support you need to get you over the top.
Well, it is interesting. I mean, at least until the current Supreme Court appointment, that evangelicals have poured a lot of political money and energy into the Republican Party and not got a lot of payoff for their buck. I think they've been in some ways sort of taken for granted in a way. They get a lot of rhetoric, but in terms of actually, you know, Roe versus Wade is still there. You know, some of those key things that they've been fighting for still exist. So
it's almost like that's the you know, they're going to gain the world and lose their souls is the way I look at it.
So the formative moment for this, really, I mean, where you see them come into politics and really make such a dent, in fact, that, you know, that later on, one of the reasons why people say in 2000 that George W. Bush was able to win the Republican primary and John McCain wasn't, was because Bush gave the nod to the evangelicals in a way that McCain just wouldn't do. Mm-hmm. But the origin moment of this is the late 1970s.
Right, we should bring it back to the 70s. You're right. It really is. And I mean, prior to the 70s, everybody, you know, as long as you were vaguely of faith, it didn't kind of matter what it was or what type it was. It wasn't a political question. You know, Billy Graham would go to, you know, whichever president and talk to them and counsel them. And it wasn't until some of these, you know, the beginning of the Cultural Revolution, the Cultural Wars, and when they heat up and it's now about, you know, sexual behavior, post-Stonewall, you know, homosexuality, Anita Bryant, all these issues that resonate with conservative Christians suddenly are deeply political and openly political in a way that they're like, okay, we're not going to just render unto Caesar. We're going to get involved and actually try to change the system.
The moral majority.
And why is it that they go with Reagan? What is it about Reagan and not about Carter, right? I mean, because you would think on the base level, Carter's their guy. Why do they choose Reagan over him?
Right. Well, Carter does win, you know, obviously much of the South at the time. I would argue less on evangelical grounds than on the fact that he was sort of outflanking the Wallace
right.
vote. You know, Wallace runs in 76, but is not George. This is George Wallace, who was very popular in the Deep South. But it's not really until the late 70s that they get going. And at this point, there's this kind of combining of Christianity with American vision and power. I think that really, you know, it has this kind of imperial dimension. That American greatness and the chosen land are kind of connected in a fundamental way within that late 70s, early 80s logic.
And maybe taking us back to the John Winthrop.
Yeah, right, exactly.
The shining city on the hill.
Which is exactly what Reagan cited in his first inaugural.
Right. Of course.
And I think it was his first inaugural. And so Carter gets up in 1979 and says there's a crisis of faith. We've lost our way. You people are buying too much stuff. You've lost your moral core. We don't have any values, which could be seen within a Christian paradigm, I think. He doesn't evoke that, but he does say church attendance is down and all this in the crisis of confidence speech. Reagan gets up and says, no crisis of confidence. We got this. There's nothing wrong with this country. That isn't great about this country. We can make this happen. And that's a very powerful, powerful message, I think, to not just conservative Christians, but to all people. I think, you know, it's a unifying vision that Carter did not have.
It is a crisis of confidence. It is a crisis that strikes at the very heart and soul and spirit of our national will. We can see this crisis in the growing doubt about the meaning of our own lives and in the loss of a unity of purpose for our nation. The erosion of our confidence in the future is threatening to destroy the social and the political fabric of America.
I look back on it and I think about Carter, and, you know, I've said this before, it's like Carter is so forgotten and so kind of marginalized that he's a living Democratic president. And that guy that sent pipe bombs to everybody didn't bother sending one.
The ultimate insult.
Think about like how just much like not being a threat you must be for this guy to be like, who's next? Carter's like 85th. Like, first let's throw in a Robert De Niro. But he's just kind of written out, and that's the way we envision him. But I think that, you know, and this is something that I've been piecing together. It's not a I think it's a decent research project to do at some point, but But it's this idea that I think this whole generation that follows learned something from Jimmy Carter, and that is, don't tell people that it will ever stop. Don't tell people there's not enough. Because what we learned from that was Carter was the first one to, I think, finally historians are talking about this. The post-World War II boom, it was an extraneous affair. It's not endemic to the way that the system works. It was a surge of money. We had 50 to 60% of the world's industrial production after World War II. We loaned the world money. They pay us back some of it. Like, it is an expansion like the world has, like the social leveling is something unlike most of history has ever seen.
And it's a shared boom. It's the most shared boom in world history.
Right. You see the wealth actually be distributed more evenly because you have unions and things like that. But I think the lesson from that, and the reason that we can't really grapple with the problems we have now, is because every politician, I mean, if I was going to write a book on like what to do and what not to do, if I was, you know, as an observer, it's don't tell people that we have to ever cut back. And I think Carter was honest. And I think that was a moment where we should have listened to him. And what Ronald Reagan said was, I got a credit card with your grandkids' names on it. Let's go get drunk. I mean, with that guy, it's more fun, you know?
Not the dour guy. Let's go with the party guy.
I think
there's actually two lessons from the 70s for the Democratic Party. One is exactly as you said. I'm not sure Carter sold that message well. I think the crisis of confidence speech was a scolding thing. And he did get a bump in the short term. And then he went and purged his cabinet and blew the political moment because now he just looked like another political operative. I don't think it was a visionary speech in the sense that it didn't provide a meaningful alternative besides individual blame. You need to stop buying things, you know, he would say, and worshiping things. And, this is when he'd be hitting the desk. So, but I think you're right that lesson number one is don't say there's limits. There's no limits on what Americans can do abroad, economically, whatever. The party goes on. But the other limit, the other lesson is the McGovern effect, which is don't go too far. that anti-war, that feminist, pro-labor, pro-civil rights. So that becomes the negative model of how the party should be. And by the late 80s, you see the rise of the Democratic Leadership Council and Bill Clinton and these sort of triangulating centrists who are really reacting to the power of Reaganism, afraid of the McGovern effect of having gone too far left. Because the obverse is the Republicans. They had the same thing. They got walloped in 64, and their Goldwater effect was double down. You know, in 16 years, they get Reagan.
Right. On largely the same message. I mean, McGovern won Arizona and like, what, four or five deep South states?
Yeah.
And he just got routed. Right. 16 years later, almost the same message works. But the thing, the pivotal point in there is Watergate and then the Church Report. Right? So at 64, when people trust the government, and, this Goldwater says, hey, don't trust the government. And they go, why? And then you get your answer 10 years later, 12 years later. And then they're like, oh, okay. And Reagan shows up. He's like, remember me? I gave that speech one time in support of McGovern. Let's do it. And they're like, all right, rip this thing down.
Wait, you just...
Goldwater.
Yeah, Goldwater.
Sorry, right. Goldwater.
Yeah, we're mixing up our McGovern. Two guys that ought not be mixed up.
Apologies to both.
Time for choosing.
God rest
right?
their souls.
Time for choosing?
Yeah. Yeah. That was Reagan's 64 campaign address for Goldwater, it was televised. There's so many lessons from the 70s that don't sink into the body politic. And the Church Committee report is a classic example. You know, they laid out, here's all the people we killed and, these coups, and here's how the CIA works. And by the time Vietnam was over, they're just like, we really don't need that. We don't need to hear that.
And for those of you who listened to our last episode with Peter Kornbluh, a lot of the documents, some of the base documents for things like what happened in Chile in 73, for what happened in Iran, for all these covert missions, this was the first moment that Americans really got their eyes and an understanding of what had been happening within the executive office. And it really, I think it broke a lot of people's confidence.
Right. And this comes on the heels of the Pentagon Papers, too. So you actually saw that everybody knew they were losing the war and we're going to proceed full steam ahead, So it was quite a 1-2 punch.
Yeah, so the 1970s, you have this moment of crisis with the church committee, with Watergate. And speaking of the long, drawn-out process, I signed the new Naftali chapter from the impeachment book by Jeffrey Ingalls, who we had on. And it really goes into this process and, you know, how, you're right, it takes a long time for people to finally turn on him. The House committee manages to bring around a lot of folks, but it gets into really, like you were talking about, these strange political alignments, because they're trying to get Southern Democrats on board with the impeachment, but Southern Democrats, strangely enough, don't want to go against Nixon because their constituents like Nixon.
Sure, yeah. And this is, I mean, you know, Nixon explicitly runs with the Southern strategy, trying to gain traction in after the Civil Rights Act, after the Voting Rights Act, you see a very slow reorientation of the Deep South to the Republican Party, and Nixon does everything he can to encourage that in the famous Southern strategy. And so this is the beginning of what we see now again, which is this very solid red South. So if we add up what we're talking about here, I mean, you think about foreign policy. We pull out of Vietnam in 73, Saigon falls in 75. The Pentagon Papers had come out. The Church Committee report comes out. Then we have the Iran crisis in 79, the hostage crisis. So as an imperial power, the U.S. is just taken on the chin. We just explicitly lost our first war. We're held, victim to this radical regime in Iran. And so that's another thing that age of limits idea that Carter puts forth really gets backburnered in favor of, we got to get back on top. Right. And that's how Reagan, you know, literally a cowboy, right, is going to hop in the saddle and ride tall.
Play one on TV. And he does. And these hostages get taken. It's really interesting, too, because, you know, we knew what we had done in Iran in the 50s with the Church Report.
Yeah.
And then this happens. And a lot of Americans, I think now when you look back at it, it's like there was a revolution and then they just took hostages. And it's like that revolution was in February. They took those hostages in November because we allowed the Shah, our old friend, who Carter had just been at his birthday party 2 years earlier in Tehran. And then we allow them to come into the United States to get treatment. That's when they take these hostages. Right. Is there any at that moment any reflection by Americans going, like 25 years ago, 26 years ago, we did basically prop the Shah up and undermine the democracy in Iran?
Yeah, we overthrew Mossadegh in the 50s. But it's the same in Vietnam. This if we look at American foreign policy, right? We face the blowback from earlier decisions, whether it's taking over the French in Vietnam in the 1950s, the overthrow of Mossadegh in Iran, the overthrow of Arbenz in Guatemala. It all comes back to roost in a messy civil wars in the case of Guatemala, the Iranian Revolution in the case of Mossadegh, and a quagmire of a war and trying to prop up the French in Vietnam. Here's kind of a mind-blowing thing. And it was Walter Lefebvre, if anybody knows who Walter Lefebvre is, who's great, one of the greatest foreign policy historians of our generation. He said to me, the thing you have to understand is the U.S. has not won a war since World War II.
Wow.
Yeah.
Pause for blowing exactly. of minds.
Right. I mean, it's amazing. I mean, there's Kuwait, which is kind of a thing, but, you know, we push them back, but it's not an out-and-out. You know, it's a mission accomplished kind of thing, but it's not a victory.
There are people who are serving in our military today who were toddlers on 9/11.
Yeah, so the sense of, you know, the militarization of American society, again, it's sort of the wrong lesson, I think, from the 1970s. It was, okay, double down on militarization, double down on global power, double down on all this stuff, rather than, okay, maybe, you know, we need to embrace a different kind of global order. And so if we lay out all those things that happen in foreign policy, similar things happen domestically, right? You know, Watergate, deindustrialization, OPEC, stagflation, the domestic politics of the Iran revolution, the failure of the Carter presidency. It's just like boom, boom, boom. It's just people are getting pummeled. And if you look at it kind of sociologically, I think you can see why people would want a restoration rather than take a risk on some wild transformation. Not that anybody was offering a wild transformation, but you know, you can kind of see like, oh, this guy is offering me the 1950s again. I'll take it.
Mm-hmm. Well, isn't that what the President Trump offered? Our friend John Fea, I don't think he wrote this, but he highlighted whoever did coin this phrase that the moral majority voters from the 80s and 90s and early part of the 2000s are now nostalgia voters. They're no longer evangelical voters. They're nostalgia voters.
Yeah. Well, I think nostalgia always plays an important role in American populism. You know, there was a golden age that we need to get back to.
So just to kind of finish up at least my portion of this, you started out by we're talking about how the things that happened in the 1970s are affecting us, our nation today, as we're almost in the 2020s. Give me three residual effects that we are feeling right now from the 1970s. Three events in the 70s that have pertinent relevance on this moment in American history.
Okay. The continuing relevance of the culture wars. That we do not have a consensus on values, however we want to frame those sets of questions. That's number one. Number two, the rise of inequality. That, you know, 1972, if I'm not mistaken, 1972 was the most egalitarian economic year in American history since the Industrial Revolution. And then it's been up and up and up, separation ever since. And the other, I guess the third I would say would be the push for deregulation and the end of kind of that the state was going to create a playing field in which corporations played in such a way that the larger society benefited, not just the corporations. So those would be the three off the top of my head.
And that is one of those things that, like, when you look at the way people talk about politics now, they will often be like, and then Reagan deregulated everything. And you're like, no, he did, but it didn't start with him.
Right, it started with Carter.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the other thing, right? I mean,
I posed the question in class the other day. It's like, you know, the whole notion, like, Nixon may be the last truly liberal president. And I said, was Carter the last truly conservative president?
Yeah, well, Carter, you know, I mean, it's clear that Carter was felt very constrained within the New Deal framework. Less, you know, and Nixon less so. I think Carter kind of bristled at coalitions. He didn't want to be bound to what they thought and began this process of deregulation. And the Volcker Fed and all that begins under his watch. And you know, we make a lot out of PATCO, the Professional Air Traffic Controllers strike in the summer of 81 when Reagan fires over 11,000 air traffic controllers. PATCO endorsed Reagan in 1980.
So then when we're talking about our defining decades or defining eras, you know, we can say we've basically said Nixon was the last New Deal president. And then the conservative Reagan revolution began with Carter.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. Yeah.
And is the Trump revolution, and I do believe 2016 was a revolution of sorts. Mm-hmm. Is that the beginning of something new, or can we say that Obama and the backlash to the election of the first black president, the rise of the Tea Party, Obama maybe was the beginning of Trumpism? Not Obama himself, but the world, the new political dynamics that arose around his election.
Well, I think I want to start with the foundation of your question, which I think is right on. That is, there are a lot of presidents, and there are only a few transformational presidents. You know, so Roosevelt, Reagan, Trump, and you know, which not necessarily that. Sometimes they're great leaders. Sometimes they are putting some pieces together in a way that are out there. It's an inchoate, and they're putting that message together. And I don't think the Trump ideology and coalition is sustainable, but I do think it is a transformational moment in American politics. And let's not forget that Obama won with a lot of white working class support, actually. Right. You know, and what they felt was, I didn't get what I voted for. So a lot of racism came out of that and a lot of anti-immigrant sentiment. But the hope and change thing, the irony is Obama was not a transformational president. He was a rational, neoliberal, African-American man who is probably one of the smartest guys we've ever seen in office, but he did not change the system.
He was a gradualist.
Yes, right.
The people, when they were chanting, And I was one of them at home in front of my television. Yes, we can. Yes, we can. Uh-huh. Yes, we can. That fever pitch of hope after the invasion of Iraq and the
08 crisis.
What did Rumsfeld call it? The slog, the just the muck of that whole W first term and Katrina and just this disaffection. We just needed something completely different.
And the collapse of the housing market. That's, you know, that's right. Really the, I mean, you know, that's, and then we went down and bailed out Wall Street. We didn't bail anybody else out.
And no one went to jail.
Right.
We've always got money to bail out Wall Street.
Right.
Our veterans didn't get paid in October, but we've got money to, I'll step back.
You know, something that was pointed out here as everybody's been talking about HW here the past couple of days is that when there was a financial crisis on his watch and people went to jail and he did it quietly, but he put, you know, these people, they paid for their crimes and Obama didn't hold them to account.
Yeah, so I think he was afraid to. My fantasy is that Clinton actually got elected in 08, saving Obama to mature as a leader. But, you know, I think there's two things that we haven't talked to about enough. One is race and how race is working in all of this. Because if we think about Bush, who was, I think, a very, HW, very classic kind of post-war, reach across the aisle, kind of work with people, understand how the world works, originally called Reaganism, voodoo economics. Yeah. We have to remember that to win, he exploited the rawest wound in American history, and that is the Willie Horton ad.
Willie Horton, yes. Oh, yeah. Oh,
in
yeah.
My book, you can pretty much do anything except rip open the wounds, the pain of race relations in America, and I can't forgive him for that.
No, and I don't think, you know, I think that the most poignant things I've heard. And because Ben and I, we just spoke with Peter Kornbluh, which led us to go back to Iran-Contra and the and rewatching the Dan Rather interview where HW and Dan Rather blew up at each other and Rather really put him through the ringer. But I think the most poignant things I've heard in people reflecting upon HW are the personal things, like the way he would reach out to reporters that, you know, like Maureen Dowd and or other reporters. One famous Washington Post reporter got cancer, and I mean, she was just after HW. When she got cancer, he and Jim Baker got her into MD Anderson and got her the best treatment, and just that more of that personal. You know, there is no perfect president. There is no perfect person. You got to do bad things probably to some extent. You have to at least sign the warrants for people's death, whether we call them an enemy or not.
He was director of the CIA,
I mean,
too.
Let's, yeah, you know. And Obama, drone strikes went through the roof under, you know, it's funny. We look at presidents and we say, this guy was a Democrat, this guy was a Republican. But an interesting study is how many in the past 50 years, how many of the policies of you know, when Clinton came into office, how many of HW's programs were continued? Mm-hmm. And when Obama took over for W, how was the war on terrorism fought? You know, I mean, Obama was going to get us out of Iraq and Afghanistan. He tried to. He got us ISIS.
So exactly. And that's the other lesson for the 70s that I think we need to keep our eye on is that we sort of had this moment of clarity around Vietnam, the Church Committee, Iran, that, you know, this sort of imperial framework for understanding American power wasn't going to work. And we doubled down on that bet, you know, and, you know, so we find ourselves in Iraq. And, you know, the other alarming statistic for me is 60% of the discretionary budget goes to the military. You know what you can do with 60% of the discretionary federal budget? A lot.
Yeah.
And if we're not winning wars, I mean, I think there's a lot going on that's not about war that stabilizes the world system, maybe in ways we're not always proud of, as Bob's pointing out. But I think there's a lot to be said for a multilateral approach in which, and here I give Trump a little bit of credit. He's like, why are we paying for all these bases all over the world? You know,
no, there are things that he's it's almost like if it was another person advancing some of these ideas and these policies, but doing it with Reagan's affability, it would go a lot further and there'd be a lot more acceptance, whether they're right or wrong, good or bad, ultimately. But think about this. I know someone whose sister came to this country 20 some years ago in the trunk of a car when she was 3 years old, right? Her letter of, hey, we're on to you, didn't come from ICE under Trump. It came from ICE under Obama, and she deported herself. And so immigration is an issue that obviously it resonates for a reason. Americans want a sound immigration policy, whatever that looks like. They want it.
I have talked to a lot of immigration scholars, and my first question is, what is the ideal policy?
Yeah.
And we know what's wrong. Pretty much everything we do, I think, is wrong. But right. What the right thing to do, besides just inject humanitarian values into it, it's not quite clear what you should be doing. Like, you know, a new Bracero program, no. You know, a new militarization, no. You know, free open borders,
why?
No.
It's hard.
It's very hard.
You know, what we need to do is do something, but have consensus on what we do.
Well, consensus.
And try to do it with as much compassion as possible.
Well, the other party polarization is another thing that we haven't really talked about that really kind of more emerges in the 90s, yeah. Prevents any kind of consensus on anything, right? If you have a good idea, it's inherently a bad idea to the other guy, other party.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think with the bipartisanship, right? I mean, like the issue that when I've read, you know, what I've read about immigration is that, like, you need to have secure borders. You also need to have a recognition that people are coming here to work. Like, if there weren't jobs here, they wouldn't be here, right? And the problem is that the Republicans have latched onto the securing the border, and the Democrats have latched onto, like, policies to allow them to be here. And that because both sides kind of whip their bases up with those two stories, both of them coming together isn't quite possible, because it would take away a lever that's pretty powerful for each party.
Agreeing with each other doesn't get you votes. Being agreeable doesn't get you votes. And there needs to be a recognition that the countries that a lot of these people are coming from, as far as Latin America, they're failed states. A lot of them are failed states where there's a lot of violence and people are just trying to survive like people have done for thousands of years.
And they're from countries where U.S. foreign policy has laid the seeds for breaking the foundations of those, you know, and breaking those states. So, you know, one of the things we have to do is acknowledge that, like, maybe we have some responsibility in this.
Yeah, well, this is, I mean, I don't want to push my other book, but, you know, in The Great Exception, basically, I made the argument that the suspension of immigration from the 20s to the 60s created a more cohesive polity that allowed for more liberal politics. And that's not an argument for closing down the borders. That's a problem you have to think about, that to the degree to which immigration is immediately divisive, immediately politicized, immediately racialized, you have a hard time coming together.
Can I say that The Great Exception would make an exceptional Christmas gift?
Yes, it would. If only it were to come out on audiobook. Available by Libro.fm. It's not, but you know what it is? Staying Alive, Jeff Cowie's book. And the last question, because we've had you on before. Mm-hmm. We've asked you how you got interested in history. What I want to know is, like, what's it like whenever someone goes, I want to make an audiobook of this? Like, how does that happen? And then how weird is it to listen to someone else reading your book to you?
I have not heard
it. And why didn't you do it yourself?
Yeah, I have not heard it yet.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
Because it doesn't come out till December 18th on Libro.fm.
On Libro.fm. So I'm excited about that. But no, my publisher just called and said they want to do an audiobook. Is that cool? I was like, absolutely. And sweeten the pot a little bit. And then, you know, it's a mere 15 CDs. What could go, you know?
Are they still making CDs for those?
Yeah.
When you guys out there without a 15 CD changer, you're going to have to get up.
So you go running with your disc, man.
The backpack on.
When does it come out on vinyl?
Hello, Road to Now listener. Seems that by being here means that you like to get information by listening to it. You might be listening right now in your car, while you're driving, maybe you're mowing your grass, maybe you're just sitting in a room by yourself staring at a wall. In any case, you're learning by listening. I like to do the same thing, which is why a couple weeks ago, I went looking for a new audiobook company and I came across Libro.fm. Libro.fm is an audiobook company which allows you to purchase your audiobooks directly from your favorite local bookstore. You can pick from more than 100,000 audiobooks, including New York Times bestsellers, recommendations for bookstores around the country, and also a playlist curated by The Road to Now featuring our past guests. With Libro.fm, you'll get the same audiobook at the same price as the other audiobook companies, whatever they are, but you'll be part of a much different story, one that supports community. If you're new to audiobooks, they're the perfect way to get more books into your busy life. All you need is a smartphone and the free Libro.fm app. If you already love audiobooks and don't know what to listen to, check out recommendations from our podcast featuring guests including Jefferson Cowie, Douglas Brinkley. There's so many of them. You can go check it out. I made the playlist myself, and I'm really proud to do this. The best part about Libro.fm is that you literally are sponsoring your local bookstore. And if you're anything like me, you really like your local bookstore, but sometimes you want audiobooks. Well, here is the solution to the problem. Road to Now listeners can get a 3-month audiobook membership for the price of 1 month. That means for just $15, you can sign up and you'll get 3 months with one free book. And if you're anything like me, you're going to download a giant biography of like Grant or something and listen to it over the course of a month. It's all the same price. $15 a month. How do you get that? All you have to do is go to Libro.fm. That's Libro. Letter F, letter M, and enter the promo code RTN at the top of the page. And they also have gifts. You can buy a gift for somebody if you're looking for that special holiday gift. Give them the gift of knowledge. Just go to Libro.fm, enter the promo code RTN, and we thank you for listening. Today's episode is edited by Gary Fletcher. Today's music is by Paul DeFiglia. We'd like to say a special thanks to our supporters on Patreon with a special shout out to our Washingtonians, Tanya Marsh, Mary Hawking, Paul Ayler, Tim and Caitlin Wells, Christopher Willis, Peggy Donica, Fig White, Jeff LeCain, and Linda Thamer. If you'd like to join us on Patreon and get extra content, go to roadtonow.com and click on support at the top of our page. Keep up with us on Facebook and follow us on Instagram and Twitter at @road_2_now. If you like what you're hearing, please take a minute and rate us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get The Road to Now. It only takes a second, and a 5-star rating and a few kind words does a lot to help us get the word out. For Bob Crawford, this is Dr. Benjamin Sawyer. Take care. Osiris.